Blog Talk Radio.
Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, October the 17th. As we like to do on Mondays, we'll be chatting with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Lots to get into today, as always, with Bill. Bill has been posting some very interesting stories about what's happening in Iran. And if you're following that, you know that there have been some major protests in Iran. Inflation, of course, the governor's race in New York. The overall situation in the country, a little depressing, but let me say hello to my friend Bill. How are you, Bill?
Reasonably well, Silvio. Reasonably well for a New Yorker living under the Democratic regime, but we'll survive.
That's right. That's right. Well, let me, you mentioned New York, and let me start with that, because there's a race for governor, an election for governor. And right now, most pundits or experts are saying that the current governor is going to be not technically reelected because she got that job after Cuomo resigned, but she's going to win. But it seems to be getting closer and closer all the time. Lee Zeldin, I think, is doing a heck of a job campaigning. And I guess my point, Bill, is if you're looking for an early sign of what the election is going to look like, I think that if by 9 o'clock Eastern time, let's say, that election in New York is too close to call, I think that's a sign that could be a major night for the Republicans, Bill. Wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think that's probably true. There's also a race in Rhode Island for U.S. Congress, I don't have details on that right now, but that also is a race in a district that is a long Democratic, but the polling shows the Republican candidate catching up. So as I understand it, that is also being considered by the pundits as an early sign, and doesn't get any earlier than Rhode Island. It's so way down the East Coast of possible trouble for the Democrats that night. I'd also add, if you're going to go along the East Coast, you have the North Carolina Senate race, which is rather close. That is a seat held by the Republican Party right now, but the Democratic candidate has been very close. She's an African-American, a large African-American vote in that state. Of course, obviously, also the Pennsylvania gubernatorial race, which is in chaos, as most things in Pennsylvania, and that would be an early indication. These are poll results that we're getting now, and poll results you don't know if they're accurate until after the election. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know how accurate some of the polling is. The general feeling that I get among people who study public opinion is that there has been a move toward the Republican Party. That does not necessarily mean a move in individual states, because we don't have a national election. We have individual elections. So I think it's going to be awfully hard. I see Fox News has President Obama's – not Obama, but Biden's approval rating at 46%, which is the highest it's been in a long time.
Right.
On the other hand, Rasmussen has it at 44, had it at 41 last week. There could be a rise in President Obama – and again, President Biden's approval approaching the election – on the other hand, the generic ballot has been predominantly Republican now for a bit of time. I think that one pollster has it at 6, one at 5, one at 4. But there are also pollsters who have the lead in the Democratic column. So it's seems to be an awfully close election, somewhat fluid toward the end. We have 3 weeks to go until the election as of tomorrow. I should point out that 3 weeks is a lifetime in politics. Anything can happen.
Sure.
There could be a last-minute event. There could be a last-minute gimmick. I'm surprised the Republicans have not yet come out with a more assertive support of its commitment to America. I'm also surprised that the Democrats have not had an October surprise of any significance. Maybe they think the January 6th hearings will provide that surprise, but at this point, I doubt it.
Yes. Well, what I find interesting is, you know, sometimes it's frustrating to follow this polling data because you say Rasmussen has him at 44 or 45, but then they also have a bunch of other stories where they show him under 40% on some of the key issues. So it's almost hard to understand how could the same organization say that he's at 40% but under 40 in the major issues. And then they show today the generic plus 7 for Republicans. So sometimes, Bill, and this is what makes all this polling data so frustrating and why you have to sort of stand back and not get too hung up on one or another. Sometimes I'm not sure if even the pollsters know what information they're getting because sometimes the contradictions are unbelievable. You have one organization, the Democrats are up by 4 in the generic, and then another organization has the Republicans up by 5. But what that tells me is that they may not be calling the same people or their samples have to be totally different, Bill.
Well, that's true. I think there's a lot of questioning of polling and how accurate it really is. There is the one outlier, which is the Trafalgar poll, which is said to be a Republican poll or at least one that leans Republican. It does seem to show Republicans in better position than most of the other polls, but it has been very right on some occasions and very wrong on other occasions. The difference is that the Trafalgar poll takes into consideration factors that are not usually included in other polls involving people's personalities, their overall attitudes toward a lot of things, and we will see on election night if the poll is valid. It is, as I said, it has been accurate sometimes, inaccurate other times. I'm fascinated by Trafalgar. I think if Trafalgar is the one that comes in as the best, as the closest, then other pollsters will have to reevaluate their methods. But that may not be the case.
Right.
We may not know the answer to that until after the election, possibly well after the election. I see that there are also some people, especially in Arizona, who are already claiming, on the Republican side, who are already claiming that the election is rigged. Now, that may be true. I mean, for all I know, it may be true. But Arizona is a fascinating state because both the Senate Republican candidate and the Congressional Republican candidate have both accepted Donald Trump's interpretation of the 2020 election as having been stolen. And there was a great fear on the part of many Republicans that these two are not going to make it because they will seem so extreme. Both are close. The gubernatorial race is very close. As a matter of fact, the Republican, Ms. Lake, is slightly ahead. In the Senate race, the Democratic incumbent is slightly ahead. But you've got so many things going on in this election, so many different emotions going on that it's hard to tell if anybody is really ahead or if that's what people are saying. One of the most interesting races is the Oregon gubernatorial race, mm-hmm. where there is a good chance a Republican will be elected. But when you look at the print, the fine print, it's because there are three candidates in the race. There's a Republican, a Democrat, and an Independent. So if the Independent takes enough votes away from the Democrat, the Republican will win. There's no runoff in Oregon. There are braces.
Which, by the way, I think that's a mistake. There should be a runoff. If you have three people running, I think there ought to be I really feel like a runoff would be helpful for the state. The idea that somebody would be elected with 41% of the vote, I've never thought that made a lot of sense, Bill.
I think you're right, and that has happened in the presidency. Remember the 1992 election when Bill Clinton was elected? There were three candidates. There was Bill Clinton, there was President Bush, And then there was Ross Perot, who got 19% of the vote.
Right.
And the result was that Bill Clinton won I think he had about 43% of the vote, but he did win the electoral vote. And
yes.
Since we decide these things by electoral vote, it was a legitimate victory. But I happen to agree with you on a local level that we should have a runoff. Now, there are some people who are touting this ranked choice voting system that was used in Alaska. I am against any system that is hard to understand, just on the basis of voting should be direct. People should know exactly what they're doing and exactly how their vote is counted. And I think that's one of those things that sounds like a score for figure skating, you know,
right.
rather than an election. But I happen to agree with you. I think there should be a clear winner.
Well, especially when we're talking about the popular vote. In the presidential election, the popular vote doesn't really matter, technically. So it's the Electoral College. So that's why in the presidential election, you got to go with the Electoral College. But for these governor's races, I agree with you that there ought to be a runoff. I was just quickly looking at the number. It was 43, 38, and 19. Those were the numbers in 1992. For that election. So Bill Clinton was elected with 43% of the popular vote. He
yes.
did win the Electoral College with like 360 or something like that. But, yeah, we'll have to wait till Election Day. I get frustrated because it seems like any time you're watching the news these days, everything is a poll. I mean, it's like
the number
of news stories that are based on, you know, this poll or that poll or, for that matter, even cable news. So I just reach a point where I say, come on, guys, is everything a poll or does anybody go out and talk to people anymore, Bill?
Well, you know, their attitude and their comeback to that will be it's the only information we have. And to a certain degree, that's true. And there are now many, many pollsters. But as we've both seen, the pollsters do not agree in many areas. And sometimes the polls are way apart. You do have... Anyway, on the generic, for example, you've got the one pollster that says the Republicans are up by 7, and then
mm-hmm.
another Democratic pollster who says they're up by 4. That's a difference
right.
of 11 points, and both are respected polling organizations. So, we'll know after Election Day. As I said, there does seem to be a feeling in the overall judgment of the numbers that Republicans are making gains. Whether they will be enough gains to win the Senate, I don't know. I think they will win the House. I think that all the trends seem to be in one direction, and that's the Republican direction. But there could be upsets there, too. But they will win. They have enough cushion. The Senate is the big thing, the big prize. And there, I think everyone is saying too close to call, maybe a slight advantage to the Democrats, maybe a 50-50 Senate again. But no one is for sure. In New York State, where we have the governorship race, as you pointed out, Lee Zeldin has done a spectacular job. He was 24 points behind,
mm-hmm.
and he is now about 5 points behind. But those are the hard points to get. It's when people begin to pay attention to the race. And, yes, it is true that people see the condition of their state, which is terrible. And apparently there is some gain for Zeldin in New York City. However, this is a very blue state, and you have people who will vote for the Democratic Party no matter what. That is who they vote for. They're not interested in discussing issues. And that is what Zeldin is up against. I think he has a chance, but as I've said many times at Urgent Agenda, this is a turnout election. It's
mm-hmm.
who's going to turn out the votes. And the Republicans, I hope, are working on that night and day to get every conceivable vote out on Election Day.
Right. Well, if you remember, Bill, and certainly I'm hoping that I'm hoping that the example of New Jersey repeats itself. You remember what happened in New Jersey in 2021, in November 2021, where the polling data was indicating the governor was up by 10, and he ended up winning by less than 1. And that was because of turnout. There was great dissatisfaction with the Democrats, and especially in the schools and the parents and all that kind of stuff. And that ended up creating a huge Republican wave in New Jersey, and the governor, my gosh, he barely made it after. In fact, in that election, Bill, as I recall, the major pollster even apologized to the voters, saying, I blew this completely. I apologize to you. And I don't recall ever seeing that before. One topic that I wanted to get into, Bill, here before we get into some of the current events, is that this is anniversary number 60 of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It happened actually this week and next week. It was in the last couple of weeks of October 62. And I don't know how much of an October surprise that was. You know, I don't think the Russians put the missiles in Cuba to have an impact on the U.S. election. But it did have an impact on the U.S. election, Bill, because President Kennedy came out much better in that midterm than maybe he would have had there not been a missile crisis, Bill.
I think that's true. Any international crisis usually winds up helping the incumbent president because people are rallying around the flag. You know, politics is put aside for a moment, and the man in the White House usually gets the benefit of the doubt. That is not always the case, but it usually is the case. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a decisive event in our lifetime, the lifetime of people who were around then. I was actually, as I think you know, in the Central Intelligence Agency at that time, and I walked in to the agency that morning as if it was any other morning. And all of a sudden, I noticed on the floor in which I worked, there were cables running back and forth that weren't there the night before. There were boxes on the side of every door, code boxes, where you punched in the code. They weren't there the night before. And I said to somebody, what's going on? And they said, well, you know, we're going to brief everybody in a few minutes. And they gave us each a code for our office so we could get into our office. And then when I went into the working section, I saw a group of guys around a big table, and there were photographs all over the table. And I walked over. I was the kid in the office. I was just a young guy, but they were pretty tolerant about letting me see things. And there were all these pictures with labels on them, missile launcher, boxed missile launcher. And one of the people explained to me that these were taken in Cuba or over Cuba by the U.S. Air Force. They were remarkably detailed. And that was, for me, the beginning of the missile crisis. I suspect other people may have known some things earlier, and the president decided not to tell Bill Katz. But I learned as a young guy what was going on, and that was the beginning of it. Now, there were a lot of misconceptions about the missile crisis that really should be cleared up. It did come as a surprise, and there was a lot of talk about a third world war. I didn't hear that kind of talk inside the CIA. I really didn't. I don't think anyone believed that Nikita Khrushchev, who was the head of the Soviet Union, I think General Secretary was the exact title. I don't think anyone believed that he was going to start World War III over Cuba. There was a great concern that if we were to emerge triumphant in the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we did, we got the missiles out of Cuba, that Khrushchev would retaliate somewhere else just to save face, and that somewhere else was generally considered to be Berlin. At that time, there was an East and a West Germany. East Germany was under the control of the Soviet Union in real terms, and there was a belief that perhaps he would block off Berlin as the Russians tried in 1948. We responded with the Berlin airlift then and eventually got back to the status quo. But that was really the great concern. One of the things that was interesting is that as the Cuban Missile Crisis went on, there were demonstrations around the White House by people on different sides of the issue. So one day, when I had off, I went down to the White House just to see what was going on. And there were demonstrators, you know, I think one phrase was ready to talk, willing to fight, stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, literally from out of the woodwork, came a bunch of American Nazis, led by George Lincoln Rockwell, with the Nazi armbands and the brown uniforms, marching in march step in front of the White House. I had never seen genuine Nazis before, and all I can say is that most of them seemed underweight to me. They seemed to be the kind of guys who joined because they wanted to join something. and they were marching, and nobody took them terribly seriously. Nobody was applauding them or even booing them. They're kind of more like laughing stocks. But that was the interesting thing that happened that day. And as the missile crisis went on, I became very, very impressed with the way President Kennedy was handling it. I had enough insight from stuff within the Central Intelligence Agency as to the questions he was asking, and they were good questions. He was a very sharp guy, President Kennedy. I always think that he was underestimated rather than overestimated. He was a man who knew a great deal about foreign policy. He had served on foreign relations. He had some good people around him, and he was sharp enough to understand how important the Air Force intelligence was of the actual missiles and the actual missile casings that we were detecting on ships that were still offshore in Cuba. And so I gave him very hard marks when the crisis ended. It ended. We had made some concessions and removed some Jupiter missiles from Turkey. These missiles were basically obsolete, and so we weren't giving up very much. But the things did settle down, and tragically, the president was assassinated a year later. But I think that as a result of the missile crisis, the perception of him improved considerably in the United States.
Yes, because before the missile crisis, you had the Bay of Pigs, you had Vienna, and you had those situations where he didn't, maybe those were not his best days, as they like to say. But I'm curious about one thing, without revealing any state secrets. When did they actually, at what point did they actually take the photos over to the White House? I mean, because you had all these photos there, all this information there, and I assume there's a chain of command. You don't take it directly to the president. I assume the director of CIA maybe goes to see somebody at the White House. But when did President Kennedy actually get the information that these photos were missiles? Do you recall that, Bill?
It was at least a few days before, because the missile crisis was not revealed from the White House. It was
right.
revealed by a New York senator named Kenneth Keating, who was a Republican. I've always been convinced that this was in collusion with the White House, that the president wanted a Republican out there revealing some of the things to give a bipartisan feel to the entire issue. But Senator Keating leaked some material. Then I think more came out, and finally the pictures came out and were shown publicly. But I think the U.S. government had them for a few days before they were actually revealed, maybe longer. I was not privy to that. But
right.
we know about the Kenneth Keating involvement, and so it would have to have been a few days before.
Yeah. Well, of course, and today would have been the 17th of October, or is the 17th of October, and President Kennedy actually spoke to the country on the 22nd. So for the
yes.
next 5 days, unless you were connected to the White House or you could see this information, the country didn't have a clue. And then there was that famous incident, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the incident where President Kennedy flew back to Washington, and the excuse was that he wasn't feeling well. But in fact, later I've learned that it was because he was coming to the White House because the crisis had gotten, I guess, pretty nasty, and he had to be at the White House in case of anything, Bill.
Yes, and he did address the nation. I think he was very good at addressing the nation, by the way. He gave people the details that he could give them, consistent with national security, as to why this was important. And people understood that, and yes, the country was tense. There was this story around, is this the beginning of World War III, as I pointed out. I don't think they really believed that that would be the case. But the government agencies that dealt with national security were all put on alert to move. In other words, if they had to get out of Washington. And that was sort of a chilling moment to be given that briefing that as to where you go. I felt if there was a nuclear attack on Washington, I probably wouldn't be going anywhere. But
right.
You know, maybe they would miss by enough
right.
that Bill would be able to get his new Chevrolet. I had a new Chevrolet. I had a new car, and it was the first car I ever owned. And it's amazing what you think of in times like that,
right? Right.
An international
exactly.
crisis. My thought were I had bought the car. I had my car loan, and I had the little ticket book, you know, each month you paid your installment, and you sent him the little ticket for that month. And I, my question was, if something happened to me, would my parents have to pay the loan? that was, you know, that's the kind of thing you think about. It's a
right.
really silly little thing. The answer, by the way, is no, because they were not a co-signer. But
right.
It was you do think about those things.
I think the car finance company would have given you a break since you got blown up by the missile crisis.
Well, probably, yes. There's probably some clause there.
Right. There's an act of God somewhere that if you get blown up in a nuclear war, that your car loan is forgiven, I guess, or something.
Well, you know,
they couldn't recuperate the car. I mean, they couldn't go pick up the car if it was a missile crisis, you know? So if missiles,
right.
I mean, so the car would have been gone too. So anyway, I'm being facetious, but I think I know what you mean.
There probably was. I can't say this definitely, but at that time, and I don't know if it's true today, there were in many insurance clauses and in insurance agreements and in loan agreements war clauses. If you lost your life, for example, as a result of a military action, very often any insurance you had was not paid off because there was a war clause exempting the insurance company for responsibility if it was a result of military action. I don't recall at that time if that was true of anything that I had signed, but it was an exciting time, tense time in Washington, but the Kennedy administration was an exciting administration. And we were, you know, it was 1962. That's only 17 years after the end of World War II. So we had millions and millions of people in this country who were veterans of World War II. And here they were going through another crisis. If we were to have a military crisis today,
yes.
We don't really have very many veterans left. Well, we have veterans of the Vietnam War. And some veterans, of course, from Iraq and Afghanistan. But that presence of World War II veterans in the early 1960s was a great stabilizing force. It really was. They were mature adults. They knew how serious things could get. You didn't have the kind of childlike comments that are made today. And I think that when that generation began to fade away, and they're now almost completely gone, their presence made a great positive contribution to the United States.
Absolutely. And, of course, the president himself had served in World War II. I can only add one quick thing here. We'll take a break, Bill, that we were actually down in Cuba. And I remember during that time that somebody did mention that, gee, what if the United States invades Cuba? And my mother made a very funny remark. She said something in Spanish along the lines, well, we'll be the first ones to go. we'll be the first casualties because if they come down here to fight these missiles, you know, we got nowhere to hide. So we'll be the first casualties of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was pretty tense down there as well, and I was down there when all of this was happening. Let me take a little break, Bill. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Iran and lots of other things in the news. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I was going to say something very quickly, Bill. The fellow whose music we normally listen to on this podcast, Carlos Guedes, he's from Venezuela. And the administration has suddenly decided that Venezuelans have to now stay in Mexico or go back to Mexico. And that is really crazy to do that to the Venezuelans, many of them who came here on the assumption that they were going to go. I mean, so I know there's a lot of Venezuelan people in the country right now, Bill, who are pretty angry by the White House making this decision. I'm not defending the original decision for them to come in, but you don't all of a sudden from one day to the other say you're going back to Mexicoville.
Well, you know, it's so confusing as to why they do these things, what their objective is. The Democratic Party, sadly today, is in a locked grip of people on the left who are basically ideologists, and they don't terribly care about the migrants or about the results of this. They care only about the ideology. So it is very hard to analyze what's actually going on. I think the president should realize, at least by now, I mean, he's an experienced political figure, that the great majority of Americans want the border closed, period. That they are not interested in Be Kind to Migrant Week. They're not interested in having an open border. They see what that's done. And you just don't get the feeling that the administration gets it, that they just don't get the American people on this issue.
Right. Well, especially either the people around him are the ones making these calls or the president is disconnected, because I don't understand who wins by having an open border the way they've done it. I just don't understand who wins. The American people don't win. You're having all these people come in who cannot work, who are going to have to be taken care of by somebody. And now they may end up working illegally, but that's not a good thing either. So the situation on the border, you have these cartels making a lot of money bringing these people over here. So I just cannot figure out, you know, what in the world, who decided this, and what exactly is the United States getting out of this, Bill? I mean, I can argue when the Cubans came, we came over like a 10-year period. And, you know, but we came gradually and in a very normal way, with the exception of that Mariel boat lift.
It was pretty orderly. Yeah.
But that ended quickly. That was a 30-day thing, and it ended. But most of the other Cubans came here in an orderly fashion. And that's, you don't see that in on the border right now. What you basically see is people coming in, and I guess they show up to New York, and now I understand they're in your hotels up in New York.
Yes,
I don't know what the latest is from that, Bill. Maybe you can bring us up to date as to what the mayor is saying these days, Bill.
Well, a lot of them are being temporarily housed in a luxury hotel in Times Square. And it's true. And a lot of them don't have any money. I mean, the hotel lodging costs are being paid for by the city, but we're getting experiences now of people, migrants, and they're perfectly peaceful, going around to other places in the hotel, knocking on people's doors, asking them for basically a handout, you know, that I'm a migrant and I don't have any money. I don't see how those hotels can survive as hotels if this is going to continue. I don't know what financial condition they're in to begin with. But they're now, I think, looking for other venues, but mostly on the west side of Manhattan, where I used to come from. It is not a popular thing in New York at all, because people have fears, some of them legitimate, some of them illegitimate, about the fact that these are illegal immigrants and they're wandering around the streets. And there's an assumption made, I think, on the part of many citizens that they will add to the crime problem. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there clearly is resentment. But still, the very people doing the resenting will still go to the polls and vote Democratic, because that's what Grandpa did. And, you know, you have the same kind of political allegiances in New York City that you have elsewhere in the country toward other parties. I mean, there are people in New York who were born into the Democratic Party. And they you know, sit in bed on Sunday reading the New York Times, thinking they're reading a real newspaper, and that's the way it's always been, and that's the way it always will be. And
right?
There used to be an expression, the term that was used was "yellow dog Democrat," but I don't recall exactly what the meaning was. But I do think it applied at one time to people in the South who would vote Democratic no matter what. Even if I don't know why the term "yellow dog" was used, but there are these voters who will not change; they just won't.
Right. No, I know what you mean, and they're not going to change at all. I just hope that they realize what they're doing to the city of New York and to the state. I mean, because it's devastating what's happening. But I just This administration, when it comes to the border, there doesn't seem to be any logic in what they're doing. I mean, there's absolutely no logic, and you just have to wonder, you know, what in the world are they thinking? Well, Bill, you've written a great deal about Iran and what's happening in Iran, and there are some major protests. I see the videos all the time, but I'm not sure that anything will change because this is one of those regimes that will do whatever they have to do to put down the protest, even if it means killing people, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. What is so shocking is the lack of response on the part of the United States. I mean, these protests have killed hundreds of people. They've killed many women. Notice the silence of the women's movement in the United States, if there still is a women's movement. I don't know. I haven't checked recently. But the administration seems to be more interested in completing the Iran nuclear deal, which is going nowhere anyway, than in coming down hard on the side of the protesters. They have made some general remarks on, showing sympathy for the protesters, but nothing militant, nothing that would get Iran's attention. I get the feeling that the signal is to Iran, well, we don't like what you're doing, but we kind of understand it, and we won't interfere because we have bigger fish to fry, and that is we'd like to complete the Iran nuclear deal. I think that's very naive. I think they have a situation now where if they really came down on the side of the protesters, they could possibly spark an internal revolution, which might be a good thing, and either diminish the power of the mullahs or eliminate it entirely. But the lax attitude by this country, I think, is quite disgraceful.
Well, it would mean a lot, I think, to the people on the streets if they would hear President Biden, give a speech in which he said, we support you. We're with you. I think that would mean a lot to these people marching. It doesn't mean that the United States is going to send troops, but just the moral support. It sort of goes back to the days when President Reagan said the evil empire. Well, there were many people in the evil empire and the Eastern Europe who were clapping when he said that because he said, hey,
exactly.
Somebody understands the mess we're in. So sometimes, you don't necessarily have to get involved militarily, but you can send a message that you support these people, Bill.
Absolutely. Well, we know from the time after the President Reagan made the evil empire speech that in Russian prisons, in the Gulag, prisoners were tapping out messages. They had their little code reporting what President Reagan had said. It was remarkable that they got the information. But they were, as you said, delighted by it. They were thrilled by it that somebody in the White House in the United States actually understands what the Soviet Union is all about. And I think right now, I don't know what the Iranians could be thinking of the Americans. We don't seem to ever really be on the side of the people of Iran. I think that there are elements in Washington that I think are part of an Iranian lobby that is close to the government of Iran. And there are some counter-lobbies, I know people involved in them, who are on the side of the people of Iran, but they really don't seem to have much clout in Washington.
Well, you remember, Bill, when President Obama was in and they had that problem in 2009, and very similar to this,
yes.
Maybe different circumstances, but similar protest, that he kept quiet. He kept quiet about it. And, Senator John McCain, I remember, was very critical of President Obama for saying nothing. And now we're in the same boat. But I have to believe that if Donald Trump was president, he would say something, Bill.
I think he would. I don't know how effective it would be or how early in the game he would get in because, he was actually quite reluctant to get involved in foreign policy
mm-hmm.
disputes. But I do think at some point he would have realized he had to say something. It's hard to know how this is going to end. It keeps going on and on, but, there are limits to this, to people's endurance. And once they start making mass arrests, it is probable that the mullahs will come out ahead again. Maybe they will think kindly of the Americans who really didn't crack down on them, but I doubt that because when you're dealing
right.
with regimes like that, they never – regimes like that never say thank you. They never say thank you. It's like people who think that if you appease the Russians, they're going to be on your side the next day. Generally not true.
No, that's exactly right. And in this case, this regime will do whatever they have to do to put these people down. But that's the reason, Bill, why it's important to support the people, because at least the people need to know that we care about them. And that would have, I think, some impact on motivating some of them to go out and take the risk of marching. But I don't know. These are not regimes that subscribe to any kind of human rights bill. They talk a good game at the UN, but back home they put down any dissent. If you dissent,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you're gonna go to prison or get killed. Unfortunately, that's what they're gonna do.
And they also depend on the political left in the West to front for them, even though they're an ecclesiastical regime. But, the attitude of the political left is anybody who's against states, wherefore? It's really quite disgraceful.
It really is, especially the women.
Oh, yes.
The feminists,
yes.
Because the women themselves have been the target of most of these. I mean, it all started, as I understand, because a woman was killed. So you would think that there would have been, that all of these, believers in women's rights would have been out marching for the sisters in Iran. No way. That's not happening, Bill.
And of course, they are getting no support at all from the groups in the United States that should be supporting them automatically, like women's groups.
Right,
and like
exactly.
Feminist groups. But they do this all the time. I mean, look at the attitude of feminist groups toward the female athletes who suddenly found themselves competing against men who claim to be women.
That's right.
You would think that they would be defending the right of women to have their independent league as they always have had, not have this new problem. But no, they were absolutely silent, because I think many of these women's groups, they may do some things for women, but their main interest is in Marxist politics. And
right.
they toe the line for the movement.
That's right. Well, Bill, one last topic I want to get into, and it's a big topic, and that is the question of inflation.
A bigger topic.
Yeah, my goodness. I mean, we got some bad news last week, and now you have this bizarre situation of, people like the Secretary of Transportation saying, well, all of this would have been a lot worse if we had not spent the money we did, which is laughable, because it was spending the money we did that gave us this. Also, it was passing the Inflation Reduction Act a month ago. I mean, that was bad timing, to say the least. But it is, it is coming across as if they don't care. They don't seem to understand how much inflation is hurting people, Bill. When the cost of food goes up 13% over 1 year, that's a big increase, Bill. I don't remember anything like that before. I mean, maybe you do, but I don't remember it, Bill.
I don't remember it. And, I'm reminded of the song from the musical play Camelot, "What Do the Simple Folk Do?" And it is sung by the king. What do those people actually do? And you get the same feeling here, that the people in charge in Washington have very little understanding of their own country. I think if many of them saw a cow, they would faint.
Either that or blame the cow for climate change. They would say the cow is responsible for climate change or something like that.
Everything is caused by climate change. And I see, by the way, that CNN, which we hoped would get better under new management, is right back to the old stuff. I mean, I was watching one CNN commentator last week talking about this hurricane that was caused by climate change. I wonder who did she speak to? Who did she speak to who told her that? I mean, they just accept this. It's a kind of a religion. But there is very little understanding or sympathy out there for the average American. And I think one of the reasons for that is that over time, the Democratic Party has ceased being the party of the common man, the party of the union worker, and has now become the party of anthropologists and civil rights lawyers. And that's basically it.
Or the public sector union.
Absolutely.
I mean, they used to be the party of private unions,
yes.
The labor unions, the machinist union, that kind of thing. But now they've become a lot more of the public sector. But, it seems like the president comes across so silly. He's sitting there eating ice cream and telling everybody how, I forgot exactly how he said it, but he said how good our economy was. And then, you know, he gives these speeches about folks are sitting at the you know, around the dinner table talking about, you know, how we're going to take care of all these people because, you know, my grandfather said to me years ago, Joey, I mean, stuff like that, it comes across so silly, Bill.
Yeah, well, of course it does. And, you know, you would think that for a man with his many, not
yes.
just years, but decades of experience, he would know better. But I think he is impaired, and I think the impairment may be growing. I have no medical knowledge to make the judgment. It's just what I see on a television screen. And I can't imagine that the Joe Biden from the U.S. Senate can be this insensitive.
No.
But he is. And the vice president, I mean, she doesn't have any idea what's going on outside her own bedroom. I mean, it's just awful. Is she there? He sends her on these trips, and I don't know what she does on these trips. Maybe she just has dinner out. But, I mean, for somebody who is one heartbeat away from the presidency, she is really become it's not just a joke anymore. It's a disgrace.
Right. Well, the other thing, too, is you have to wonder. I mean, you're right. She's a heartbeat away from the presidency, and you have to wonder if, God forbid, something were to happen to Biden and she were to become president, how ready is she? How informed is she of the issues that are facing the country? Now, you know, you've talked before about Harry Truman, and Harry Truman came in, and he had to learn some things. But Harry Truman was a much more qualified man than this lady is. I mean, he had experience
yes.
in the Senate and had a lot of common sense. You really have to wonder, I mean, I think it worries a lot of Americans. I think it worries a lot of Democrats if she had to step in the office, Bill.
Oh, it does. There was an article out today and about the fact that there are some Democrats privately, acting privately and on their own, who are making plans for the 2024 election should Biden not run. And
mm-hmm.
I think when they talk about, quote, making plans, the interpretation I have is we have to keep Kamala out of this.
Right, exactly.
I think
you're exactly right.
There's a general feeling that she's unelectable. Well, what do you do, though, if she's vice president? And she's
right.
a, quote, woman of color. You've got a lot of sensitivities there.
That's right. Well, a couple of quick things, Bill, I wanted to bring up. I'm sure you heard President Obama over the weekend disappointed with his party and the cancel culture and that, you know, we're talking too much about Trump, we should be talking about the economy. I mean, it makes sense for him to say that. I'm glad he's saying it. But he didn't propose any ideas. You know, he didn't say, you know, those college professors need to stop talking about pronouns or those guys. You know, it seems like he said we have a problem, but he really didn't fix the problem, Bill, I guess, or even talked about fixing it. It just seemed like to me like just a lot of talking, Bill.
Well, I think that was exactly the feeling most people had. He himself has got to be very careful about what he says because he will be involved in some way in the 2024 campaign. In what way, I don't know. I mean, he can't run again,
no.
but he could be the man whose endorsement everybody wants. So he is proceeding cautiously. He's going out and doing the minimum, really, for the party as
mm-hmm.
it approaches the midterm. And I don't think he wants to tip his hand as to anything that would indicate that he is against Kamala Harris being nominated. But I don't know anybody who wants her nominated. So I don't know whether she could be prevailed upon. She might have to be prevailed upon, you know, but it would probably have to be a meeting between her and her husband in which they just go over the basic reality, and that is the basic reality is that she has very little support.
That's right. Yeah, she's not – there's not a lot of people coming out for her. One thing, too, Bill, and I don't know how familiar you are with this, so I bring it up. I'm not sure if you heard this, but over the last hour, I read over at Powerline that the new prime minister of the UK is in deep trouble, that she may not survive. Anything that you could add on that, Bill?
Well, when she came in on the heels of Boris Johnson being basically mm-hmm. shown the door by his own party. The Conservative Party in Britain is not, even though it's the majority party right now, it's not strong. It is divided. There are factions. Liz won really because she wasn't somebody else. And her ideas are very good. They're really Margaret Thatcher's ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But they may not be the ideas that will work right now. She withdrew a tax plan after touting it. She fired her Chancellor of the Exchequer, who had only served really a few weeks. I don't even know if he had time to redo his office. And the feeling is that she might not last long herself. If she is forced to resign, I don't know if they can force you to resign, but she could be made to resign. I don't know who they have. I think they got rid of Boris Johnson too quickly. He was a character, no question about it. And they didn't like a character in the Prime Minister's office. But they are going to face an election in a few years, and we dread the possibility of Labour winning an election in Britain.
Right.
It will become a very, very different country, far less attached to the United States. But she is in trouble. She's not terribly popular in her own party. And even when she was first selected, there was a lot of murmuring that she won't last long. And it appears that because her economic plan has had to be withdrawn, that maybe it's time for her to go. Then
well,
you have a real problem.
Yeah, but there was a lot of praise of her economic. If you remember, Bill, there was a lot of praise of her economic plan. People were saying, hey, this is exactly what we need. And then she starts backing down. That's probably her mistake. When you start backing down in politics, then people sense weakness, and that's a bad thing. One last question, Bill. We're just about out of time. I wanted to ask you one question. This is a little humor. Wouldn't you love to have President Trump go before the January 6th committee?
I would love it. I think he would love it, too. I think he's playing this game, you know, that he has to resist it on grounds of separation of powers.
Right.
And he certainly doesn't want to appear before the election. But after the election, I think he would love to get back at them. And he would put on quite a show.
He would. That's my point. Because, you know, I bring this up, Bill, because the other week President Biden was interviewed by CNN. And less than a million people saw the interview, which is embarrassing, really, for CNN and for the
yes.
White House. I mean, you have the President of the United States. You would expect at least the top audience that night, but he gets less than a million. Comes in number three, I guess, in the cable news ratings. I bet you that wouldn't happen if President Trump was speaking in front of the committee.
That would be
the highlight of the night. That would be game seven.
The best show in town. The best show in town, and he would go for broke. He'd be ready with all kinds of lines.
Right.
Oh, there, I think they would have to bring in the sportscasters.
That's right.
To do that.
There'd be replays. You know, there would be replays.
Oh,
of the whole night. But I can just imagine him opening the event, Bill, when they introduce him, looking at Mr. Thompson, you know, the chairman of the committee, and saying, Mr. Thompson. Yeah, don't you remember when you said I was not legitimate and you didn't want to count my Electoral College vote?
Yes,
just remember
that,
Mr.
Yes.
In fact, I've got a video of you saying that, Mr. Thompson, and then the others as well. It would be entertaining as heck. In fact, it would be so good that I would love to see it. But after the election, you're right, Bill, not before the election, after the election. You know, when we have that time there between the election and the new Congress, things always slow down a little bit. That would be the time to do it, Bill. It would be, it would make Broadway, it would be so amazing. It would be the most incredible performance in recent memory, Bill.
Oh, absolutely. They'll be playing There's No Business Like Show Business. I mean, and they, I can't wait.
Yeah, I know. I feel the same way. It's probably not going to happen, but I would feel the same way. I think it would be entertaining as heck. Well, Bill, thank you as always for your time. Have a wonderful week. Keep up the great work at Urgent Agenda, especially all the articles that you post about Iran. They're very informative. And thank you so much, and I guess we'll see you the next time, Bill.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward to
right,
getting
Bill.
Close to that election.
That's right. Have a wonderful day, Bill.
Same to you, sir.
All right. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, another hour that just flew by. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Cantu in Dallas.